Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Along with Gachun, Chilcat weaver Lily Hope is one of 15 people to win a $100,000 SHIFT Award. The Transformative Change and Indigenous Arts Award is a new program from the Native Arts and Culture Foundation. Hope is mentoring weavers and addressing Indigenous land sovereignty in her project and will split the funds with her partner organization, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with Lily Hope and find out more about her project. Hi, Lily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for talking with me today. Would you please tell me about the grant that you were recently awarded by Native Arts and Culture Foundation?
Yes, this is a new grant with Native Arts and Cultures Foundation. They have shifted to a SHIFT program, supporting Indigenous artists, elevating Native issues and voice. The actual wording is SHIFT, Transformative Change and Indigenous Arts. My project is protecting the material sovereignty of our Indigenous homelands.
The grant will be split between yourself and your partner organization, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. So what is the connection between your work and the Gold Belt mission?
Well, a Gold Belt mission is to similar actually to NACF in supporting Indigenous arts, supporting Native peoples in language, in culture, in all that we do, with Gold Belt, with an emphasis on engaging youth. So that's going to be a large part of what the work that we're doing together. And my work is to find someone to fill my shoes, but also to navigate the climate change and hunting restrictions that we have here in Southeast Alaska with the cedar stands that are freezing to death, essentially, and the mountain goat that we can only hunt during a short window of time with a smaller volume of hair.
As you just referenced, one part of your new project will focus on raising awareness about the issues around mountain goat hunting and also cedar tree conservation. Would you please say some more about that?
Thanks. The issue is that we have been making Chilcat dancing blankets for hundreds of years using mountain goat hair and cedar bark, two very accessible materials, or I shouldn't say very accessible, but they are traditional materials available to us in our backyard. We can walk up the mountainside, you know, get some goat meat to eat and use the hair as we do wherever you go in Alaska with Indigenous peoples, that we use the whole animal, right? It's pretty difficult to hunt a mountain goat. That's one thing. But the other part is that we are allowed to hunt in the fall time before our mountain goats have built up a winter bulk of hair, which means we have to kill more goats to get the same volume of hair that we would have gotten if we killed a single or two in the springtime. So my hope is that we can negotiate with the powers that be to allow us an Indigenous hunting rights outside of our Department of Fish and Game parameters.
And so in addition to changing the rules of the mountain goat hunting, there is also cedar tree conservation. And is that also due to the acquisition of materials for your artwork?
It is. We spin cedar bark into the warp, right? The core of our work, we weave over cedar bark and mountain goat, or used to be mountain goat. We're using a lot of merino, but yes, we need cedar bark for the structure of our warps, right? So that we can create curvilinear form line shapes, circles, and our fibers don't crush in on themselves. The issue was brought to my attention a couple of years ago by a friend, Shabadrang Khalsa, who was taking an environmental science class out at the university here in Juneau. And she brought it to my attention that there are cedar stands within walking distance of Juneau, but it's like a pretty steep terrain. You almost want to use climbing ropes over by Thunder Mountain. And she said that her team went out there, her class went out there, and found that the underbrush of the cedar stands isn't growing the same way it used to. So the roots of the trees are freezing to death, essentially. And because of the difficulty of the terrain, what can we do as humans is my question. What can we do to, you know, are we going to helicopter bales of hay up? Are we going to insulate the roots? Is this a thing that we need to be protecting, right? That we're going to physically participate in insulating the roots of these trees? And is this going to happen every year? Where's the money going to come from if that's the case? Or are we taking a different route and looking at what are the replacements of cedar bark? If we can't, if in the next 100 years our cedar trees are gone, what is a possible substitute? What does that look like? And as Indigenous peoples, we've always been resourceful, right? If we can't find it in our backyard, we'll trade across the border. We'll go down into the Cascade Mountains. We've been trading, you know, there's Tlingit potatoes that are 10,000 years old, right? They came out of South America. So we have been trading long distances for a very long time. Is there another tree or another source where our trees are not freezing to death that we can access our yellow cedar?
That's very interesting. What would be your preferred outcome if you could wave a magic wand?
I'd love to continue to use yellow cedar. It feels like home. It feels like the work we've been doing for thousands of years. But I'm acutely aware of how much we've already adapted to the changes in the world because we have the means to do so. Because our trading is so much more accessible now. We don't have to travel for 2 weeks to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. How do we have a foot in both worlds and navigate that and continue to produce work that's meaningful?
It seems to me that a lot of your livelihood is dependent on grants, and that you spend a lot of time writing grants to secure finances so you can continue to work as an artist full time. That seems like a full time job in and of itself. It seems like an art form of its own. How do you feel about working in a field that's sort of set up like that?
It is really challenging to recognize that the making of art is only like 20% of my time. And that the best artists in the world that we can still like call back on always had a team of support behind them. They had someone making their meals, they had somebody watching their kids, and it could have been the wife or the husband, right? They had someone prepping their canvases. They had a patron who was saying, hey, here's a sum of money to pay you for the next 6 months. I want first dibs on your next paintings, right? I mean, it has changed a lot. And then the whole like social media marketing thing and getting your work out there. But I have to keep this mantra going that being an artist does not equate being poor. And I'm willing to do the work and stay up until 2 a.m. and figure out what my support team looks like so that I can change that 15 to 20% art making to like 60 or 70% art making. And I can say, hey, while I'm sitting here and my hands are moving, can you craft this social media post for me? And hiring a photographer, that has been life-changing. I mean, career-changing.
The other part of your project will focus on mentorship. Who are the weavers that will be learning from you?
That isn't public knowledge yet.
I see.
There are a couple weavers who have pretty much proven themselves in self-drive. And I'll say that that is one of the top things that I look for now in apprentices. Those two weavers are working every day in the art form in Chilkat, and I'm excited to partner with them.
So how does this award, this grant, rank among some of the other accolades you've received in your career?
It is the largest dollar value grant that I've ever received, which I'm so grateful for, to have the support to continue doing the work. It's blowing my mind, and I spontaneously break into gratitude tears on the regular.
Well, apart from your partner agency, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, who are some other groups you're hoping to work with as you move through the stages of this project?
You know, I keep thinking about Chilkat and Ravenstail Weaving in the bigger sense of the world textile art. So I have my eye on like the Mid-Atlantic Fiber Association here in the US. I am hoping to partner with museum in Scotland or the British Museum in London. I've got world sites, and I feel like the grant itself is going to help to secure those partnerships. But the bigger goal, not just exposure of climate change and hunting restrictions and getting someone to fill my shoes because I won't be in the physical realm forever, but it's really to get people thinking about Chilkat and Ravenstail weaving as present day, made today art. That this isn't 200 years ago, this isn't 10,000 years ago, we are here. We are still weaving these ceremonial objects. And hopefully I get to live long enough to see that, where people can come back and they look at a Chilkat dancing blanket and say, whoa, I know what that is. I know where they're made and I know that they're still being made. So yes, I'm hoping to make it global. Let's go global.
I just thought of another question going back to the mountain goats and the cedar. Were these materials available in abundance, or did past weavers also have to adapt or exchange or substitute one material for another if there was a scarcity or a lack?
Great question. When we look at the old Chilkat dancing blankets, they had a higher volume of cedar bark than what we're using now, because we're mostly using merino wool in place of mountain goat. We're using like a dental floss thin strip of cedar bark, because merino is so much easier to get than climbing up a cliff and getting some yellow cedar. So the ratio was completely flipped on its head, that the Chilkat dancing blankets, the warps of them were like 80% bark and 20% mountain goat hair. So we didn't really need a full 7 mountain goat hides to make a Chilkat dancing blanket. So we kind of flipped that over now that we have easier access to merino. And we have always been resourceful in recognizing that these are slow art forms, right? So the records, the ethnographic records show that we send mountain goat inland to our Tlingit Haida Tsimshian relatives inland, like over the mountain range, Atlin, BC. And we'd send it to them and say, hey, process this, send it back to us as warp. And even send bark with it, and they would send us the warp back so that we could focus on the weaving of the blankets.
Have you yourself been involved, personally involved, directly involved in mountain goat hunting?
I have yet to hunt a mountain goat, no. And I know that it is more than a one-person job to bring the mountain goat meat and the hide down the mountain, because the hide itself can be 30 pounds.
What are some of the challenges you foresee as you complete your projects?
Accessibility and sheer volume of hours of processing the work. Not just getting the hide off the mountain, but how many hours are we going to spend fermenting the hide and then hand pulling it off of the hide and then brushing it, washing it, carding it, like all the things. And that's where my question is of, is it necessary? Is it the best cultural step forward? Is it mandatory for us to continue to use mountain goat? If it is gonna add twice, if it's gonna double our workload, and we're already paid half as much as carvers and painters, what's the benefit of returning to mountain goat? Or is it actually better to find some more easily sourced, similar, really fluffy, you know, cashmere-like hair? I don't know. Those are the questions we want to answer, is, you know, why? Why did they shift away? Why? And if we can't secure the goats that we need, what is the alternative? And if we choose not to, fly up the insulation for our trees, what is the alternative? Is there one?
Do you expect pushback or resistance from some of the bureaucracies that you'll have to engage with?
I don't anticipate a lot of pushback. I think of myself as a pretty decent negotiator and or listener. And I believe in the goodness of people and that when we're asking for things, we're really expanding our relationships as we move through this work. So I feel like Terry Rothkar has already built a relationship and that the precedent has been set for her and a couple of other hunters in Sitka, Alaska to go up and get these goats. So I feel like it'll be kind of like picking up where my clan sister left off. Hopefully. I'm hopeful. I'm Lily Hope and I'm hopeful.